Ron. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verse 255 of chapter Baqarah, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahu la ilaha illa huwal hayyul qayyum. لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات وما في الأرض من ذا الذي عنده إلا بإذنه لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات والأرض من ذا الذي يشفع عنده إلا بإذنه يعلم ما بين أيديهم وما خلفهم ولا يحيطون بشيء من علمه إلا بما شاء وسع كرسيه السماوات والأرض ولا العلي العظيم.
صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Allah is He, besides whom there is no God, the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist. Slumber does not overtake Him, nor sleep. Whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth is His. Who is He that can intercede with Him but by His permission? He knows what is before them and what is behind them, and they cannot comprehend anything out of His knowledge except what He pleases. His knowledge extends over the heavens and the earth, and the preservation of them both tires Him not, and He is the Most High, the Great.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
US President Joe Biden says he will confront what he calls aggressive actions by Russia and China. China says the US is deliberately creating tensions after an American warship sailed through the Taiwan Strait. Also ahead, the Palestinian Prime Minister condemns Israel for demolishing a Bedouin village in the occupied West Bank. Good to have you with us. Our top story this hour, the US President has outlined his foreign policy agenda. Joe Biden has promised to engage with Washington's allies and confront America's rivals. But he didn't cover all the major issues he's expected to clarify his position on.
In his first major foreign policy speech, US President Joe Biden has laid out his administration's strategies. He opened his remarks by declaring that America is back. During his wide-ranging speech, Biden took sideswipes at his predecessor Donald Trump as he gave repeated assurances that Washington will strengthen diplomatic ties with its allies to confront what he called rising authoritarianism by the U.S. adversaries, including Russia and China.
We will not hesitate to raise the cost on Russia and defend our vital interests and our people. And we will be more effective in dealing with Russia when we work in coalition and coordination with other like-minded partners.
The president called for the immediate and unconditional release of Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny, who's sentenced to 3.5 years in prison for violating his terms of parole. Continuing with China, Biden referred to the Asian country as the U.S. most serious competitor. He vowed to take a tougher stance against the country, including taking moves to confront what he called Beijing's economic abuses. Elsewhere in his speech, the U.S. president called for an end to the Saudi-led war on Yemen, declaring a halt to Washington's support for the devastating 6-year-long conflict.
This war has to end, and to underscore our commitment, we are ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales.
He added that his administration will push for a diplomatic resolution in Yemen and will make sure that humanitarian aid reaches the Yemeni people. He, however, added that his administration will continue to support Riyadh and help the Arab Kingdom to defend itself. Biden later called on Myanmar's military junta that staged a coup and detained the country's civilian leaders over alleged election fraud this week to relinquish power, warning them of consequences. He further referred to measures he has already taken to reverse the previous administration's policies, including the re-engagement with the World Health Organization on the COVID-19 pandemic, the U.S. return to the 2016 Paris Climate Accord, lifting the so-called Muslim ban, increasing the cap on asylum seekers to 125,000, and halting U.S. troops withdrawal from Germany. Absent from his foreign policy speech, however, was mentioning of the U.S. stance of Iran and how Washington will proceed with regard to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. He had previously pledged to return to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, but several cabinet members later said there was a long way before the U.S. could return to the international accord, which Trump withdrew from. Biden, like his predecessor, seeks to overturn policies implemented during the previous administration. How far-reaching those changes are going to be, and how lasting and practical their effects would be, is anybody's guess at this point.
China has accused the U.S. of deliberately creating tensions after an American warship sailed through the Taiwan Strait.
The U.S. move is a repeat of its old trick of mixed manipulation of the situation across the Taiwan Strait, deliberately creating tensions and disrupting regional peace and stability. We are resolutely opposed to this. No matter how the situation in the Taiwan Strait changes, theater troops will loyally perform their duties and mission, resolutely safeguarding national sovereignty, security, and territorial integrity.
The Chinese military said its forces had followed the and tracked the ship. The U.S. said its warship conducted a routine transit on Thursday in accordance with international law. Taiwan made the same comment. China considers Taiwan as part of its territory. It's opposed to increased U.S. support for the island that seeks independence. The U.S. support includes arms sales and sending warships through the Taiwan Strait. China sees the measures as interference in its internal affairs. It says the U.S. should respect the One China policy. Ai Sun U is a senior fellow at the Singapore Institute of International Affairs and joins us now. Ai Sun, welcome. Thank you for joining us. So you've got a new U.S. administration, yet same words, same action.
Well, indeed, I think on the one hand, the United States considers the Taiwan Straits to be international waters, whereas China considers it to be, in a sense, inland sea. So the U.S. Would send its warship to pass through the Taiwan Straits. And on the other hand, the Chinese side, they have also sent a number of warplanes, sort of encroaching upon Taiwan's territorial waters as well as skies. So both sides, I think, are saber-rattling a little bit, especially now that there's a new American president on the scene.
Is this about Taiwan or China's economic growth?
Well, of course, with China's economic growth, the so-called comprehensive national power would grow as well, and that would include its military projection or its military capabilities. And China, as you said, over the years have seen Taiwan to be an inseparable part of China, and thereby, to reunify Taiwan from a Chinese perspective would be something that is very natural. Taiwan also, as you pointed out, it may have independence tendency, or it may want to so-called retain the status quo. But for China, retaining the status quo is almost equivalent of seeking independence. So China, I think, would not be quite happy about Taiwan's attitude.
Absolutely. And just to expand on that a little further, why this massive military support to Taiwan? You've got American warships passing through China's backyard, because China poses no security threat to the United States.
Well, from an American perspective, I think they would like to contain China within the so-called first island chain. which starts from Japan all the way down to Okinawa, Taiwan, and then the Philippines and so on, to prevent China's so-called deep water navy to break through this chain and thereby, for example, threaten U.S. bases in Guam and even Hawaii. So from a U.S. perspective, their presence in East Asia and in Southeast Asia has been longstanding, at least since the Second World War. From China's perspective, I think increasingly China is adopting some form of a Monroe Doctrine, claiming that at least Taiwan, if not, shall we say, a more expanded region, would be at least a sphere of influence.
Okay, thank you very much indeed. Sun Oh, Senior Fellow at the Singapore Institute for International Affairs. Now, moving on, Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shataya has slammed Israel for demolishing a Bedouin village in the occupied West Bank.
This settler colonial phenomena, we have seen it, replacing people by people, replacing indigenous people with settlers. The Palestinians have been here for thousands of years. This land is our land. We are here to protect it.
Shataya said the Israeli demolition is part of ongoing measures in breach of international law and humanitarian treaties. The EU representative to the Palestinian territories also urged Israel to respect international law. The two officials were speaking after they visited the demolished Palestinian village. Israeli forces, accompanied by bulldozers, destroyed the homes of some 60 Palestinian Bedouins on Wednesday. Israel claimed the homes were illegal. An Israeli rights group said the demolition left 61 people homeless, over half of them children. Now, Iran's permanent representative to the United Nations says the new U.S. administration is not off to a, quote, good fresh start in its approach towards Iran. Majid Tahtaravanchi cited Washington's disappointment at a verdict by the International Court of Justice on a case concerning anti-Iran sanctions. The top UN court had ruled that it can take up Iran's bid to overturn U.S. sanctions reimposed by former President Donald Trump. Tahtaravanchi said the new U.S. administration's dismay at the judgment comes despite its claims of supporting multilateralism. He also pointed out that the U.S. is still in violation of UN Security Council Resolution 2231 by upholding illegal sanctions against Iran. The resolution endorsed the 2015 nuclear deal that removed the sanctions. The European Union's foreign policy chief says it's time to move from maximum pressure to maximum diplomacy with regards to Iran. Josep Borrell said the U.S. withdrawal from the 2015 Iran nuclear deal prevented the agreement from reaching its full potential. He said he's in contact with all the signatories to the accord to salvage it. The top EU diplomats welcomed the new U.S. administration's indication of a new approach on Iran. He stressed that all participants are ready to engage. Meanwhile, the French President Emmanuel Macron has called for expansion of talks with Iran beyond its nuclear program.
But I do believe that we do need to finalize indeed a new negotiation with Iran, and President Biden has a critical role. First, because they are much closer to the access to the nuclear bomb now than they were before the signature of JCPOA in July 15. Second, because we have to address as well the ballistic missiles issues, and we have to address the stability of the region. And this comprehensive agenda is to be negotiated now, because this is the right timing. And we have to find a way to involve in this discussion Saudi Arabia and Israel.
Iran has time and again rejected calls for changes to the 2015 nuclear deal and its original participants. Tehran says it's an international agreement that has been endorsed by the UN Security Council and is by no means renegotiable. The US withdrew from the accord in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Iran. In response, Iran rolled back some of its commitments. US President Joe Biden has said he will return to the agreement, but only after Iran returns to full compliance. Tehran, however, says Washington must act first by removing all of the sanctions. Donald Trump's legal team has dismissed a request from Democrats for the former U.S. president to appear before Congress and give evidence for his impeachment trial. Trump's advisor, Jason Miller, said the ex-president will not testify in a, quote, unconstitutional proceeding. two Trump attorneys also called the request a public relations stunt. Democratic representatives acting as impeachment managers have asked Trump to testify under oath at his impeachment trial in the Senate next week. Trump faces the charge from House Democrats that he incited the deadly insurrection at the U.S. Capitol on January the 6th. Trump's lawyers have rejected the charge, contending that he executed his duties as president fully and faithfully. If convicted, the Senate could hold a second vote to disqualify the one-term president from seeking office again. Political commentator Edward Corrigan says it's difficult to prove former U.S. President Donald Trump deliberately incited the Capitol attack.
Well, if I was a lawyer, I would not want him to be before the Senate to give a presentation or to be asked questions. I think the risks are too large, and Donald Trump, quite frankly, is not capable of explaining himself. And if you followed his speeches over the years, quite often he reverses himself. He says one thing, he says the opposite. And there are some very skilled former litigators that would be in the Senate from the Democratic Party that would be questioning Mr. Trump. But the other thing is that they don't want to bring any more undue publicity to this or legitimate it in any way that will hurt Donald Trump or the Republican Party. The Democrats, I think, have to take some sort of stand because of what Trump did, because he clearly incited the crowd to go on a rampage and to attack the Capitol buildings in the United States. So it's a very fine line, but ultimately I think it's a hard thing to prove that he deliberately incited the crowd to attack the Capitol building, and which resulted in at least 7 people dead and many more people being injured. Luckily, there was no members of Congress or the Senate that were injured. But, it clearly went right up to the edge. But how do you prove intent? And, my view is that, they want to damage Trump and hurt the Republican Party.
Staying in the U.S., where the House of Representatives has voted in favor of stripping a Republican lawmaker of 2 high-profile committee assignments. 11 Republicans joined the Democrats in a 230-199 vote to approve the resolution which removed Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene from the House Budget Committee and the House Education and Labor Committee. Greene has been under fire for her incendiary remarks, including support for violence against the Democrats. Greene expressed regret for remarks she made before entering office but failed to apologize. She argued that what she is being accused of are words that she has made in the past and do not represent her now. The United States says it had no involvement in a 2016 attempted coup in Turkey. The State Department described as wholly false the recent accusations by Turkish officials. It said the unfounded claims are inconsistent with Turkey's status as a NATO ally and partner of the U.S., On Thursday, the Turkish Interior Minister said the U.S. had managed the coup attempt while Gulen's network carried it out. Fethullah Gulen is a Turkish opposition figure based in the U.S. Ankara has long accused him of being behind the 2016 putsch, something that Gulen has strongly denied. More than 250 people were killed in the failed attempt. Pakistan's opposition parties have agreed to hold a mass long march towards the capital, Islamabad, to force the government of Prime Minister Imran Khan to resign over alleged rigged general elections. Javed Rana has more from Islamabad.
These are senior leaders of combined opposition parties, including Pakistan People's Party and Muslim League of former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif. They gathered in Islamabad to decide new course of action after opposition's deadline to Prime Minister Imran Khan to resign expired. After hours-long meeting, they announced that people from all over Pakistan would start a mass long march towards the capital Islamabad on March 26 this year to force the government of Prime Minister Imran Khan to step down and hold fresh general elections. The opposition blames the military to have rigged general elections in favor of Prime Minister Imran Khan in 2018.
We are struggling to get rid of an illegitimate government which was formed through rigging in general elections. We are trying to restore the sanctity of the public mandate.
A better sense must prevail among the opposition parties. The opposition must understand that their protests would not bring down our government. When we were in the opposition, we held protest rallies in Islamabad for 126 days to bring down the government.
The opposition launched a public mobilization campaign late last year across Pakistan to prepare people for the long march next month, something which government believes received a lackluster response. Prime Minister Imran Khan says that the opposition parties turned against him after he rejected their backdoor request to stop prosecuting top opposition leaders on corruption charges. The opposition's decision to start a mass long march has come after anti-graft watchdog started prosecuting top opposition leaders on money laundering charges. The former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif has already been convicted on money laundering charges.
Analysts believe that the opposition parties enjoy little public support after their top leaders were tainted with the corruption charges. However, discontentment prevailed among people over unprecedented price hike after Pakistan devalued its currency under IMF pressure, something opposition failed to exploit in its favor. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
On Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive. And make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver, Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
Islamic Revolution, Inspirer of Elites and Heroes. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, today is the sixth day of the 10-day dawn, which marks the period in which the Islamic Revolution of the Iranian people triumphed over the oppressive Pahlavi regime and put an end to 2,500 years of tyranny and oppression for good. The Islamic Revolution was undoubtedly the most important event in the contemporary world and the 20th century. The Islamic civilization has trained bright talents in a variety of fields who have played very effective role in the history of mankind. They were the choicest of people who didn't act for their vested interests, but for the interests of the society and human community. They loved serving fellow humans rather than being hungry for power. The Islamic Revolution, too, paved the way for thriving of talents and capacities in different domains. Thus, the more aged this revolution becomes, the number of elites increases in various fields. Since the advent of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini attached high value to acquisition of sciences and technologies. As the revolution has originated in Islam, acquisition of knowledge enjoys a lofty position in it. Just like Imam Khomeini, Ayatollah Khamenei too considers the elites and scientists as the choicest of the society and called them spiritual assets. 20 months after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Saddam Hussein, the Iraqi dictator, imposed the 8-year war at the behest of his masters in the East and the West in a vain bid to overthrow the Islamic Republic system. Yet, the wishful thinking of the global arrogance didn't materialize, and the Islamic Iran came from strength to strength as the brave youth poured to the fronts and put their talents into practice. The war was indeed an arena for manifestation of a big variety of capacities among the young generation. The war caused the Iranian nation to rely on its own capabilities in the face of problems and shortages. Before the Islamic Revolution, there was no authority to handle the affairs of the elites and bright talents. But after the revolution, especially during the past two decades, different organizations have been set up for recognition of and support for the elites, and there has emerged a sort of scientific movement in the country. Currently, more than 12,000 elites have been supported by the National Elites Foundation. leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said, "Today, knowledge in the human level, not just the national level, stands on specific borders. We can have our share in breaking these borders and going forward to broaden borders. We should broaden the border of exploration and knowledge. That I attach value and respect to the elites is because of this view. Our elite can be effective in the state of life, in the state of planning, in the state of the country's progress, and in the state of human progress. The holding of over 10 public meetings with scientific elites and weekly meetings with them shows the leaders' high opinion on scientific advancement. According to the statistics, before the Islamic Revolution, Iran had no outstanding scientific at the global level. But in 2016, according to the figures of Web of Science, Iran had 208 scientists among the 1% top scholars in the world. This ranking is conducted on the basis of scientific documents and the studies of world researchers in 22 fields during 10 years. This comes while the scholars of Islamic seminaries are not taken into account in this review. The spectacular breakthroughs in different spheres such as nanotechnology, stem cells, biotechnology, space, and nuclear sciences are witness to high potentials among Iranian youth. During the past years, the United States has left no stone unturned to impede Iran's march towards scientific pinnacles. The U.S. resorted to scientific and technological sanctions against Iran to isolate the country. However, these sanctions exposed the hidden talents of the youth. The domineering system, spearheaded by the U.S., has ceaselessly tried to exploit the wealth and resources of nations for its vested interest. By the same token, it has also tried to put embargoes on science and technology to hinder the way of getting access to wealth and resources. Thus, the elimination of elites and heroes has been put in the agenda of global arrogance and Zionism. That's why, every now and then, they assassinate some of the great scientists and heroes of the Islamic Republic of Iran. The terrorist operations against national heroes such as Martyr Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh can be evaluated in this context. This has been on top of the enemy's agenda since the victory of the Islamic Revolution, when great personalities like martyrs Motahari, Beheshti, Mufatteh, Rajai, and Bahonar were targeted by a hired terrorist. But contrary to the enemy's wish, the Islamic Republic of Iran has covered the path of honor more strongly and resolutely with faster steps on the course of advancement.
The very first revolution that started with the people, continued with the people, did not change its word, did not change its way, did not decrease or increase its goals, is the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei.
Ministry.
The siege imposed by Kurdish contras known as Syrian Democratic Forces SDF on the areas controlled by the Syrian Arab Army in the cities of Hasake and Qamishli has entered its fourth week, with the continued prevention of food, fuel, and flour from reaching these areas. The SDF tightened its blockade by restricting civilians wishing to enter and leave these areas, including school buses, from transporting students, which led to the inability to start the second semester in public schools. Residents are forced to cross unpaved off-roads and walk long distances on foot to reach the Syrian Arab Army-controlled areas to run their daily errands in light of the difficulty in acquiring and transporting food and other products to their families, or even worse, to reach a doctor's clinic for follow-up treatment, medical care, and obtain medication. Syrians in Hasake and Qamishli are also living in complete darkness at night due to the running out of fuel used for operating electricity generators and the restriction of grid electricity to only 1 hour per day. As a result, scores of people are taking to the streets on a daily basis in marches that roam the streets of the cities of Hasake and Qamishli towards the Kurdish contras checkpoints in an attempt to break the siege and open the roads. The Syrian Democratic Forces, however, confronts these moves by firing bullets in the air, dispersing the protesters by force. Reiterating their refusal to open the roads to secure the movement of civilians between the two cities. Kurdish contras affiliated media are justifying the siege imposed on the cities of Qamishli and Hasake as being a response to the Syrian Arab Army's siege of the Ashrafieh and Sheikh Maqsood neighborhoods and the town of Tal Rifat in the Aleppo Governorate. An accusation which the Syrian government denied it even existed in Aleppo, stating that the life is operating normally in Aleppo and its countryside, adding that Damascus believes that the Kurdish contras are making up these accusations with the single aim of implementing foreign agendas as per directives from the American occupation. Welcome to the Middle East Stream, Ammar Osman. The siege imposed by the Kurdish contras known by the name Syrian Democratic Forces on the neighborhoods under the control of the Syrian Arab Army in the cities of Al-Hasake and Qamishli continues in light of the escalation of the sufferings of the people and the faltering of Russian efforts to find a settlement that ends the siege and restores matters to their previous state. The situation is prompting scores of Syrian residents to walk great distances to bypass the Syrian Democratic Forces checkpoints. To discuss this issue with us from Perth is Maram Susni, who's an analyst and political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Maram, at this late hour in Perth. But crowds of Syrian civilians have been holding several protests against the Syrian Democratic Forces in the cities of Hasake and Qamishli in Syria's northeastern province of Hasake, which led to preventing the entry of food and many other necessities to government-controlled areas in Hasake, and lately even led to the murder, to the martyrdom of one of the Syrian security officers in Hasake as well. What are the Kurdish Contras doing by besieging these cities, and why are they refusing any sort of deal with the Syrian government so far?
I think this is a sign of the new Biden administration. Basically, they're acting under the instruction of the U.S. occupation, and the new Biden administration has emboldened these Kurdish Contras. Essentially, under Trump, he made some statements akin to the Kurds aren't angels, they weren't there for us during World War II, and his policy was not to promote the Kurdish SDF, and he basically didn't want to alienate Turkey for them. But Biden has said repeatedly that once he gets into power, which he did, he's going to support the Kurds and basically choose the Kurds over Turkey. So I think that this is a sign of the Biden administration's emboldened efforts to destroy and balkanize Syria. The SDF, the Kurdish Democratic, or the Syrian Democratic Forces as they're labeling it, they have now been sieging the areas under Syrian government control for 13 days, not allowing food and flour in. But it's not just these pockets of areas in Al-Hasake and Qamishli. The reality is that they've been sieging the entirety of Syria. The northeast of Syria, which is under U.S. occupation and under the control of the Kurdish Contras, that has 80% of Syria's oil and 80% of Syria's wheat, actually, even more than that. Basically, it's the breadbasket of Syria.
Well, Maram, the airport of the city of Qamishli is one of the most important sites that is within the hands and control of the Syrian Arab Army in the city of Qamishli, and now it falls under the siege of the Kurdish Contras, and lately tension began to develop between both the forces of the Syrian Arab Army and the SDF, whether it's the SDF or the Asayish as well. And the government is condemning these acts, and they're saying that the Kurds are owing up to the plans and to the support of the U.S. occupation in the eastern part of the Euphrates. But it just baffles me that so many times the Kurds have been dropped like hot potato by the U.S., to be honest. They have disappointed their Kurdish allies on and on again. But such a strategic spot like the airport, for example, is most definitely an end goal for the Kurdish Contras. Could that actually be the igniting point between the Kurdish forces and the Syrian Arab Army?
It's been a strange situation in the northeast of Syria, because you kind of have this weird balance between the fact that the Syrian military is still holding the most strategic locations like the airport in Qamishli and like the roads in Al-Hasake. And recently when Trump claimed that he was going to pull out of Syria, the Syrian military also has checkpoints along the M4 highway. And at the same time, the Russians are there, the Turks are there, the Americans are there. And it's all sort of a weird Cold War. Sometimes it gets hot as well between all these sides. And I think that the U.S. is trying to muscle the Syrian and Russian forces out. And instead of doing that themselves and triggering a response from the Russians, they're using the Kurds to do that. I think that the siege on the airport is a part of that.
But, Madam, one thing that's very also interesting that's happening right now in the eastern and northeastern part of Syria is, as reported by Sana, the Syrian Arab news agency, it reported that the U.S. occupation forces are now deploying logistic materials and military equipment to build a new military base in Al-Ya'rubia area, which is in Syria's northeastern province of Hasake, where everything right now is going ballistic. So that's also near the Iraqi border. So a new base near the Iraqi border, and last week moving Daesh prisoners from the northern part of Syria to the 10th base, which is on the border with Jordan as well. That signals an upcoming military maneuver. What is Biden really preparing for Syria here?
At the very least, he's trying to block any imports of oil and food from Iraq into Syria. They want to slow down the Syrian military offensive against al-Qaeda in the northwest of the country, in Idlib, and possibly they want to create a resurgence of ISIS. I mean, it's not a coincidence that we recently had some ISIS attacks against Syrian military in the area, and we know the Americans have been using ISIS and terrorism in the region for the last decade or more, in fact. So, since Afghanistan in the 80s, pretty much. So, I think that our military, Syrian military, and the Russians need to stop trying to negotiate, stop trying to play this diplomatic card. The SDF, the Kurdish Contras, have chosen their side. Unfortunately, they've chosen the side that will basically leave them in the lurch at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. And perhaps it's easier to negotiate with the Turks than the SDF.
Well, in the meantime, we heard of Russian efforts that are continuing to find some sort of a settlement between the Syrian Arab Army and the Kurdish forces. But we heard that unreasonable demands by the Kurdish side have hindered this talks, and especially they are talking about the, if you will, besiegement of certain areas in Aleppo, saying that this is a retaliation, this is why we're besieging Hasakah now. But in the event of an actual confrontation between the two sides, because as I said, they already killed one Syrian soldier who is a pro-Syrian government soldier, what will be the role of Russia in case they actually go face to face?
At the end of the day, Russia is going to choose Syria. They've shown that time and time again. The Kurds are a card that they are willing to use as a balance against Turkey, mm-hmm. and the Russians are, fighting Turkey on multiple fronts, including in Libya. But, you know, the problem with the Kurds is that they are in the Americans' camp, and I think that the problem is the Russians are also trying to pressure Syria into accepting some of these demands, mm-hmm. and these demands are unacceptable. Mm-hmm. The demands of the Kurdish Contras is to Balkanize Syria and to create an ethnocentric state and make the northeast of Syria, so every part of Syria right now belongs to every Syrian. And they want to make it such that the northeast of Syria only belongs to Kurds. Mm-hmm. They want to ethnically cleanse every other ethnicity and put them under their power. And they're not the majority. They're not the majority in the area.
They represent only 7% of the Syrian population, the full Syrian population. But I wish we had more time to talk about this. But hopefully, again, up next when we see what happens in Hasakah. I want to thank you very much, Maram Susli. You are an analyst and political commentator joining us from Perth to talk about how the Kurdish Contras are besieging Hasakah Governorate. Thank you very much for being with us. Now, please stay tuned. We will next be talking about how Riyadh is being targeted with drones.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Social networking sites in Saudi Arabia went frenzy last week by news of an explosion heard in the Saudi capital Riyadh, with claims about Saudi air defenses intercepting a missile said to have been launched from Yemen. However, Wilayat al-Wa'd al-Haq, which is a previously largely unknown Iraqi resistance group, said it targeted Saudi Arabia in retaliation for the Daesh Baghdad market bomb that killed 32 Iraqis. Riyadh under drone attacks in this following report. Saudi Arabia announced that it intercepted and destroyed a hostile air target over Riyadh on January 23rd. The Saudi government did not provide additional details on who conducted the attack or from which direction it came. Saudi media only reported that residents in central Riyadh heard the explosion overhead and implied attribution for the attack to the Yemeni Ansarullah resistance group. However, a previously unknown Iraqi resistance group, Alwiyat Wa'd al-Haq, which translates to the Righteous Promise Brigades, claimed responsibility for the attack. An Iraqi telegram channel claimed the group targeted Al-Yamama Palace, the official residence of Saudi King Salman bin Abdul Aziz, with a fixed-wing kamikaze drone. The statement blamed Saudi Arabia for supporting Daesh and indicated that Alwiyat Wa'd al-Haq may next attack the United Arab Emirates unless Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and Emirati Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed, quote, cease their crimes, unquote. Alwiyat Wa'd al-Haq indicated that the attack was part of the Balanced Deterrence campaign, which the Yemeni Ansarullah had launched in 2019 to retaliate against high-value targets in Saudi Arabia, such as critical oil infrastructure and defense assets. Ansarullah had always framed their Balanced Deterrence attacks as a response to the Saudi-led coalition's continued air campaign and blockade in Yemen, and had timed their previous attacks as retaliation for Saudi strikes that caused mass civilian casualties. Similarly, the Iraqi Alwiyat Wa'd al-Haq stated that its drone attack was the beginning of the transfer of Balanced Deterrence to the center of Saudi Arabia in revenge for the blood of the martyrs. It is worth noting that this attack came 2 days after Daesh, which Saudi Arabia supports and funds, conducted a mass casualty terrorist attack in Baghdad at the hands of a Saudi Wahhabi Takfiri terrorist. Experts believe that these weaponized drones are for sure a game changer since they operate like floating munitions. They are comparatively inexpensive and expendable and carry around 30 kilograms of explosives, enough to do some damage but limited in their potential destructive capacity, however enough to make Mohammed bin Salman sleep with one eye open. Now to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Ali Murad, political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Ali. So an Iraqi resistance group claimed responsibility for the kamikaze drone attack into Saudi Arabia on January 23rd for the second time in recent years coming from Iraq. But we are used to news like this coming out of the Yemeni retaliation against the ongoing Saudi brutality and aggression against the people of Yemen. However, what is the significance of such an attack coming from Iraq this time?
Thank you. I think that, as you mentioned, we are used to press releases by the spokesman of the Yemeni armed forces, Brigadier General Yahya Sariya, to come out and tell the world that Yemen launched missiles attacking some sites, military sites, or even oil facilities inside Saudi Arabia in retaliation of the aggression, the continuous Saudi aggression on Yemen. But this time, it was remarkable that Sana'a immediately denied that it has launched any missiles or any military operations in the Saudi lands. So we saw this press release of the Alwiyat al-Wa'd al-Haq, which is a new group. It's the first time we hear about this name. There's nothing confirmed up to now, but in case this was really an Iraqi group, this means that the era of retaliating against the Saudi aggression and the sending of suicide bombers inside Iraq and funding ISIS and other Takfiri groups to mess in the Iraqi places, though This means that the Iraqis have took the decision to stand for this game that is, which is obviously trying to play it again, because they played it before in Iraq and in Syria, and people thought that after the defeat of the ISIS caliphate that Saudi Arabia and the Americans are not going to repeat the whole movie again. But it seems that on the first day of the Biden inauguration, ISIS attacked inside Baghdad, killing like 32 Iraqis. And it happens that one of the attackers, the suicide bombers, was a Saudi national. So the Iraqis have the full right to retaliate against any Saudi aggression that attacks the Iraqi civilians or facilities, because the Iraqis know exactly what it means that Saudi Arabians, the Saudi regime, I'm talking about the Saudi regime, has blood, Iraqi blood on his hands.
Well, what's interesting is that just days after this drone attack against Riyadh, we heard and saw U.S. President Joe Biden temporarily freezing arms sales to Saudi Arabia and to the United Arab Emirates in the wake of the humanitarian crisis inside of Yemen and the continuous Saudi-led war against the Yemeni people. Do you think that this decision will actually prompt maybe Mohammed bin Salman to halt his war games in the region for a bit?
You know, the people close to the Biden administration and the Democrats in general, they are trying to convince us that the Democrats and the Biden administration truly wants to end the war on Yemen. We have to remember all the time that the Democrats, the Obama administration, was the one that
started
the war. It was declared from Washington, and the Obama National Security Advisor went out to the press and talked about the operation, the decisive storm. I think that the Biden administration wants to send some messages to the world in a approach to, you know, to renovate the abilities of the United States in soft power and, you know, after what Trump has made to the diplomatic relations with America's allies and also the foes. So I think that they are trying to show that there is a new administration that will work differently from the previous administration. So yeah, we will halt or freeze the arms shipments to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, but there is one point that has to be taken into consideration. The true intentions of the Biden administration might be concerning some suspicions of corruption. Mm-hmm. Because before Pompeo left the State Department by 2 months, the Inspector General in the State Department was fired, because he launched an investigation, an internal investigations, about accusations for Pompeo of having some funds, you know, some corruption funds from the Saudi and the UAE regimes to pass those arms shipments. So I think that the Biden administration wants to invest in this to show the world that they are keeping their words and their promises during the campaign, the presidential campaign, and they want to stop this war. So the press secretary in the White House went out and said some strategic goals has to be met, and part of them stopping the war on Yemen.
Well, he didn't actually say stopping the war. He actually said an attempt to end the warring factions.
Yeah.
He didn't even say stop the war. That's how good they are. They try to
end,
work on the words. But the potential expansion of the Iraqi resistance factions' ability and their willingness to target Riyadh, if that's actually true, if this is actually what happened, and in coordination with the components of the other allied forces of the resistance, and I mean here Ansarullah and other factions of the Popular Mobilization Units and probably other factions actions in Syria as well. I mean, that would for sure pose some sort of a growing security challenge to the U.S. and its regional partners as well. But I highly doubt that the U.S. is ready to allow this to happen. But in reality, what options really does the U.S. has to stop this sort of coordination between the allied forces of the resistance?
Well, we all know that the Americans and the Zionists try to, hold those remarks of, the cooperation, the rising cooperation between the allies and the region from Iran, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, and Yemen. We all know that the Americans tried their best regarding what was taking place on the Iraqi-Syrian borders, for example. We all know that years ago, the Iraqi forces and the Syrian Arab army and its allies in eastern Syria, they tried to open the borders the Americans tried their best. They even came with their soldiers to the Tanf base. I think the Americans tried their best to stop this, but they couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
As we all know, we must always remember that martyr General Soleimani,
yes,
he succeeded in this, in making the coordination between all those parties in the region, the liberation parties in the region, come into a successful experience, because mm-hmm. what's taking place now in Lebanon and Palestine and also in Yemen and in Iraq is a true example that all the forces that are trying to liberate their lands, they can work together. And I think that the Biden administration in the coming months and years will try to break those bonds between the allies. They can start with Yemen, for example, by trying to offer something for the Yemenis to make them to isolate them from the rest of the opponents components of the resistance axis,
mm-hmm.
to try to make a settlement or some kind of a deal of or a compromise, a political compromise, to isolate Sana'a from the rest of the capitals.
But that still has